Okay, so this lecture, entitled Intermarriage and the Rabbinical Council of Brunswick, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilu nishmos of Yehuda Svi ben Rabbi Chonin Yitzchok, Rachel Estel Bas Rav Moshe, Dr. and Mrs. Leon Arietta Hirschman Salam Shalom, of blessed memory, and Rabbi Rafal Moshe Pinchas ben Rabbi Yehuda Tzvi, Dr. Rafal Maurice Hirschfuss, Olav HaShalom, of blessed memory. In the lectures of the previous series, we traced the dramatic changes within the Jewish community, beginning from the pre-modern era, where virtually the entire Jewish community was dedicated to the practice and study of Torah, to the modern era, which was marked by the widespread abandonment of traditional practices, the breakdown of rabbinic authority, the increasing number of young men and women who had virtually no Torah education, and the emergence of university-trained rabbis who had integrated the secularism of academia into their Weltanschauung, their world outlook. Many of these so-called, quote-unquote, enlightened rabbis no longer believed in the authority of the Bible and Talmud and were prepared to make major changes in synagogue ritual and daily observance in order to keep the growing number of non-observant within their communities from totally abandoning Judaism and ultimately the entire Jewish community. Now, at the beginning of the 1840s, these reform-minded rabbis made up only a small minority of the entire rabbinate and only functioned within their own isolated communities. In such circumstances, there was little chance that any of them could make any significant headway towards their goal of modernizing Judaism, especially in the face of resistance from many of their traditionally minded congregants. It seems, according to historians, that up until the 1850s, the majority of German Jewry were still Orthodox, at least in practice. These reform-minded rabbis understood that only by assembling together could their united voices be heard and their influence be felt. The person who originally began the process of unifying those rabbis bent on reforming Judaism, and probably the single most influential individual amongst this movement, was Abraham Geiger, the subject of a previous lecture. In the year 1837, while still a rabbi in a small community of Wiesbaden, Geiger sent a letter to his like-minded colleagues inviting them to assemble in his community to discuss future plans for implementing reforms. The quote, so the first quote on page one, is an excerpt of that letter. And in the middle of the letter, if, however, a number of rabbis make unanimous declaration as to the non-essentiality of this or that observance, the bonds of formalism will be loosened. And he continues, I confess, he concludes, that it cannot conceive how we can hold up our heads if we will not stand courageously for our innermost convictions. I cannot rest satisfied to continue to wear a mask any longer. Politic as such a course would be undoubtedly, like, politically correct. I leave it to your own conscience to decide how friends of truth and integrity will judge us, and by what name posterity will stigmatize us if we continue to speak high-sounding phrases but to enact weak deeds. All in all, some 15 rabbis were in attendance at this first Reform Rabbinic Assembly in Wiesbaden. The conference, however, yielded little in practical results, and all that the attendees resolved to do was to write articles regarding practical steps for implementing reforms and have them published in Geiger's magazine, Wissenschaftliche Zeitschrift für Jüdische Theologie, the scientific journal for Jewish theology. In addition, a commission of three rabbis was established to prepare a reform manual for domestic prayer. Although the results were meager, historians view this conference as having planted the seed for future assemblies, and it was in those assemblies in which a formidable movement for Reform Judaism was born. Although these reform-minded rabbis did not formally meet together again until the year 1844, during the years following the Wiesbaden Conference, they did make their opinions known. In the year 1842, after Chacham Bernays, the chief rabbi of Hamburg, attacked the newly revised Reform Siddur prayer book of the Hamburg Temple, the Temple Association published the opinions of some 12 like-minded Reform rabbis in support of the prayer book and Reform doctrine. This was in addition to the published opinions of doctors Zacharias Frankel and Abraham Geiger in opposition to the opinion of Chacham Bernays. Later that same year, in the midst of the controversial appointment of Dr. Geiger as rabbi in Breslau, Geiger's admirers collected and published in two volumes the response of 17 rabbis who defended his qualifications for that position, despite Geiger's public denial of the divine authorship of the Torah and with it the authority of the Bible and Talmud. All of this was covered last year. Now, in the midst of all of these controversies, and in light of the firm conviction held by the reform-minded rabbis that the only practical solution to the continuing problem of mass defection from Judaism, on the one hand, and the key to overcome the persistent resistance of the German governments in granting Jewry an equal place in society, on the other hand, was to implement major changes in Jewish practice. This was what they felt was the key to everything. At the beginning of January 1844, Dr. Ludwig Philipson, the rabbi of Magdeburg, an editor of the most widely circulated Jewish publication of the time, the Allgemeine Zeitung des Judentums, the General Journal of Judaism, published the following open letter to the rabbinate of Germany. Again, their desire, those of the Reform, was A, to make Judaism more appealing to those who are already assimilated, and B, to make Jewry appealing in the eyes of the government so they'd be worthy of they'd be granted as full emancipation.
When was that first conference?
So the Wiesbaden was in 1837. Or this already was 1844. And here on paragraph B of your first page, and this was again taken from his open letter. Let us speak plainly. The issue is no longer the permissibility or non-permissibility of this or that synagogal institution, or this or that alleviation for civil and social life. The issue before us is concerned with the entire content of our religion, which we must present and strengthen in its purity and divinity in order to rescue it from deadening rigidity on the one hand and from benumbing unbelief on the other. Judaism is weakening in its hold upon its followers day by day, and every layman is asking us, what are you doing? The objects of the conference shall be one, to bring the rabbis into closer relation and acquaintanceship. Two, to promote unanimity in the conduct of the rabbinical office. Three, to further the founding of communal institutions. And four, to counsel together on all Jewish affairs. The letter reaped its promised results as a group of some 25 rabbis or preachers met in Brunswick or Braunschweig, Germany, to begin the process of reforming Judaism. With the exception of Dr. Abraham Geiger from Breslau and Dr. Leopold Stein from Frankfurt, the communities which these clergy represented numbered in the hundreds rather than in the thousands. For the most part, the religious views of the attendees of the conference was in line with Geiger's. Those who felt bound by the authority of the Bible and Talmud, but yet desired small cosmetic reforms, made up only a small minority amongst the attendees. They were readily visible as they were the only ones amongst them who wore yarmulkes, skull caps. Now, the Brunswick Conference lasted for 8 days, from June 12th to June 19th, 1844. Since this was meant to be the first of a long series of assemblies, The first order of business was to create a framework through which this and future assemblies would be most productive. To that end, they decided upon using the parliamentary form, i.e., the members of the assembly adopted statutes, selected officers, followed standard protocol, and reached their decisions by majority vote. They did agree upon one caveat, however, that the rabbis would still maintain their autonomy, and thus the resolutions of the assembly would only be, quote-unquote, morally binding, and then only for those of them who voted with the majority. But despite all their protests to the contrary, the assembly had all the appearances of a legislative body for Reform Judaism and had the effect of giving the reform-minded rabbis a strong and united voice. In addition, they decided that all of their deliberations would be made public, open to reporters and guests. Now, although various serious issues were brought up during this first assembly, they were by and large referred to the committees that were set up during the conference, which were to deliver their reports at future assemblies. Two of the most significant issues which did come to a vote was regarding the Kol Nidre recitation at the beginning of Yom Kippur and the form of the humiliating oath that the various governments within Germany imposed upon the Jews before they would be allowed to testify in court. Since the Kol Nidre in effect absolved the community from their commitments of Nidorim and Shvuas, vows and oaths, anti-Semites would often use this to prove that their promises or vows in general, and the oaths that Jews made in court in particular, could not be trusted. The Brunswick Assembly, with apparent unanimity, declared that the Kol Nidre was not an essential part of the service and should be abolished. Now, regarding the special oath of the Jews, it was common custom in the various German states that before a Jew would be allowed to give testimony in a court of law, he was required to go to the synagogue accompanied by the judge, the rabbi, and 10 Jews above the age of 13. He was to be dressed in a tallis and tefillin, holding up a Sefer Torah. The rabbi was then told to impress upon the potential witness of the severity of swearing falsely. The witness swore according to a set formula and gave assurances that he would not have the oath annulled through the Kol Nidre service, and that he did not consider a Christian to be an idolater. The Brunswick Assembly declared that this demeaning practice should end and that Jews should be believed with a simple oath, just as his Christian counterpart. To give you a better idea of what transpired in Brunswick during that week, I quote now on page 1, paragraph C, from the concluding address of the conference by Dr. Joseph Mayer of Stuttgart, the rabbi and quote-unquote church counselor of Württemberg, and president of the Brunswick Rabbinic Conference. And this is, as we conclude our labors for this year, I deem it necessary to address a few words to the distinguished assembly. As you look back over the progress of our discussion during this first and certainly most difficult and important assembly, we have every reason to be satisfied. Even though the results are not of great import, at least so far, still, what has taken place is assurance that greater things will happen in the future. The statute on which we counseled, on which we accepted, contains, to be sure, only formal regulations which shall govern further assemblies and discussions. However, in so important a matter as that which brings us together each year, even the form is not unimportant. It gives to our association a firm basis to some less important matters. Three important subjects were prepared and referred to commissions for further study. The revisions of Jewish marital law will help to do away with essential defects in this portion of Jewish life. In the future, will also help to do away with many inconveniences and conflicts. And just as an aside, eventually the Reform Assemblies permitted a divorcee to marry a Kohen, a priest, and also allowed a woman whose husband never had any children to remarry without a chalitza, without the leverage and the ceremony to dissolve this levirate marriage. And we continue. Even more important is the preparation of a new liturgy and a new prayer book for home and public worship. If the commission which has been created for this purpose will undertake and complete its task in the sense and spirit in which this distinguished assembly has expressed itself, then indeed it will have the most wholesome influence on the religious life of the Jew. Finally, you gentlemen have recognized and appreciated in its full extent the importance of the matter which we have just discussed, namely the Sabbath. And again, it says future assemblies would modify the Sabbath observance. It continued, to be sure, those who would like to make sweeping reforms will not be satisfied with these results, but we cannot let these people deter us. One must sow first in order to achieve spiritual harvests. The spiritual tree must first be planted and nurtured before one may have fruit from it. On the other hand, those of rigid and formal belief will accuse us and will throw suspicion upon us, and perhaps the thoughtless will mock us. But even these will not deter us, for conscious of our good cause, neither suspicion to the right of us nor mockery to the left of us will bother us. And with a zeal which will not cool, with a self-assurance which will not be moved by every whim, we shall pursue our task with that thoughtfulness which takes time and circumstance into consideration. The task is to maintain and develop our religion, to revitalize the religious service. Let us understand the time, let us utilize it, but let us not force from it that which it cannot give us. For, quotes, he who forces time, time will force him. And he says, Kol adochekas asha, Shadoch Koso, which is taken from a Gemara in Erev in Yud Gimel Amud Beis, which is indicative the Dr. Meir did not totally forget his learning. Let us take away from here the conviction that the good cause to which we have dedicated our time, our effort, our life will remain victorious, and finally that our holy religion, purified of all dross and additions, cleansed of all that is merely local, ephemeral, of all disfigurations which adhere to it, will rise in new glory to fulfill its mission to mold mankind into one brotherhood. At this point, everyone is required to applause. To give you a better idea as to the meaning of prayer, which is, quote-unquote, purified of all dross and additions, and to give you a better understanding of the religious sentiments of Dr. Meir, the president of the conference, and his fellow reform-minded rabbis, I quote to you from Dr. Meir's speech in support of a motion to establish a commission for the creation of a new prayer book. Gentlemen, it is not unknown to you how in recent times the religious sense has unfortunately diminished in many Jewish families and has disappeared from others altogether. Perhaps we may blame this in part of an unfavorable attitude to religion in our time. However, the larger share of the blame must be placed on the fact that the presently available books of worship and the present ritual of public worship do not conform to their original purposes. Our ordinary prayer book, Sefer Tefillah, suffers in formal as well as material aspects from so many ailments, it is no longer in a position to satisfy the religious needs of a progressively educated generation. The language in which it is written has for many centuries been unintelligible to half of the congregation, namely the women, and now it has become a secret for 9/10 of the people, a thick wall of separation between the worshiper and his God, which makes a spiritual attitude and true exaltation of the spirit impossible. Attempts have been made to relieve these defects by adding to the Hebrew text of the prayers a German translation, but this in itself proves the purposelessness of a dead language and its inability to achieve a vital, life-giving spiritualization. When with every word he speaks, the worshiper must look to some translation printed below or above in order to understand it, then worship becomes an exercise of the mind rather than an exaltation of the heart. Another technical defect of our prayer book is the repetition of individual prayers in the very same prayer service. For instance, the early morning service, the Shema Yisrael, occurs twice. The Ashrei, this is Psalm 145, also twice. And the Kedusha even three times. This defect is emphasized and made worse in the public service, since here certain prayers are repeated 5, 6, and even 7 or 8 times. For instance, Birchas Shmon Esrei and Birchas Sheva, this is on Friday night, this Kaddish and others, Every repetition is boring, tiresome, negates devotion, makes the whole service a formal opus operatum. Finally, I consider the lack of the truly poetic element as a technical defect of our prayer book. With the exception of the Psalms, which are found in it, and these are only spoken as prayers, there's an almost complete lack of hymns and songs, in fact, of any kind of piece that can be sung. I said, because of time, says you can read the rest. But he just says, but I have underlined in the middle of all this, of the next paragraph. Finally, the prayer book contains prayers and pieces which are in contradiction to the beliefs of a large part of the congregation. As for instance, the prayers which have reference to a personal Messiah, the return to Palestine, and the sacrificial cult. It says, even the pure and better prayers suffer from a certain poverty in religious thought and sentiment. Thus, a single religious idea is not infrequently repeated six or more times in the very same prayer, only with different expressions. This renders these prayers in their present form equally sterile. If we accept the Psalms and a few other prayers, we find in the whole prayer book very little which truly speaks to a soul longing for edification and exaltation. In addition, the prayer book collection has no prayers for the special times, situations, and circumstances of life which the heart yearns for consolation, atonement, and peace. In vain will the father and mother of a family take the prayer book to hand on the occasion of a sad or joyful event, for they will find nothing in it which will speak to their sentiment or is relevant to their needs. The defects from which the prayer book suffers are not improved by the form and manner which is used during public worship. We already note the frequent repetition of individual prayers which make the service boring, halting, and unedifying. In addition, there are the long and ununderstandable disquisitions which of necessity cause boredom, encourage talking and conversation with neighbors, interfere with order and quiet, and contribute nothing to the dignity of the house of God or the worship service. The calling up to the Torah, the Tzkiyah Shofar, the Tilas Lulav are customs which no one would claim that in their present manner of practice they encourage meditation and edification. Finally, the whole manner of conducting public worship service is not adequate to its purpose. Even though recently many improvements have been made through the adoption of synagogue rituals and choral song, the basic evil has not been eliminated. The song of the synagogue must be accompanied, carried by a fitting instrument if it is to make a contribution for exaltation and edification. Keeping in mind the principle Da'ilach Hakima Beremiza, it is enough for a wise man just to hear a hint. I will limit myself to mere hints, knowing that you gentlemen here have long recognized the defects of our prayer book and our ritual order and entirely convinced, even as I am, of necessity of a new prayer book and a new liturgy. However, the more important such a subject is, the more careful thought must be given it, and therefore I do not ask of the commission, which I have suggested be instituted, that it should immediately begin considering the creation of a new prayer book and a new worship agenda. I ask only that it lay the necessary groundwork for it. But of all of the resolutions that were passed in this first assembly in Brunswick, the most controversial and the one that laid bare the chasm that divided the reform-minded rabbis of Brunswick from Jewish tradition was their resolution in regards to intermarriage. It is important to note that a major impetus for instituting change in Jewish religious life was the perceived necessity of easing their integration into the larger society and thus leading to their being granted full equality by the government. To that end, Dr. Ludwig Philipson proposed that the assembly fully endorse the 12 answers that the Parisian Sanhedrin in 1807 gave to Napoleon, which we covered in a previous lecture. Similar to what actually occurred in the French Sanhedrin, the answer that was the most subject to debate was in response to the third question, may a Jewess marry a Christian or a Christian woman a Jew? Or does the Jewish law demand that Jews should only marry each other? Although the participants of the Brunswick Assembly wanted to be accepted by their Gentile neighbors and therefore officially allow such marriages, They're also aware that such a policy would eventually lead to the dissolution of Jewry. Now, the actual answer the French Sanhedrin gave was a masterpiece in diplomacy. But it was couched in such terms that led to some misinterpretation. It read as follows. I quote, "The Grand Sanhedrin, taking cognizance of the fact that in the French Empire and the Kingdom of Italy, no marriage is valid unless it has been preceded by a civil contract before a public official, before a public official declares its virtue of the authority granted unto it." So they resolve the following: that it is a religious obligation for every Israelite in France as well in the Kingdom of Italy to regard from now on civil marriage as a civil obligation, and therefore forbids every rabbi or any other person in the two lands to assist in a religious marriage without it. Without it having been established beforehand, the marriage has been concluded according to the law before a civil officer. The Grand Sanhedrin declares further that marriages between Jews and Christians which have been contracted in accordance with the laws of the civil code are civilly legal, and that although they may not be capable of receiving religious sanction, they should not be subject to religious proscription. This translation was taken from Gunther, this is Dr. Gunther Plaut's work, The Rise of Reform Judaism. It is important to note that the head of the Sanhedrin was a Rav HaGoyim, Rav David Zinsheim, one of the leading rabbinic scholars in Europe. The answer was phrased in such a way that pleased the French government while not compromising the halakhic stance of mixed marriages. All that it said was the mixed marriage would not be subject to religious proscription, which simply means a ban or punishment, which the Jewish community of France was no longer free to exercise in any case. As we shall see, the Reform rabbis of Brunswick interpreted this to mean that mixed marriages were not actually forbidden according to halacha, according to Jewish law. I would first like to go over with you, just to touch upon the source in the Talmud regarding mixed marriages. And this is on page 4. And I'm just going to, you can look at yourself, really I'm going to summarize the discussion of the Gemara. The discussion of the Gemara deals with measures that the combined assembly of the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, came together to issue various rules of legislation. One of the areas which they touched upon was basically to ensure that the Jews would not assimilate in the diaspora. This assembly took place before the destruction of the Second Temple, sometime during the first century of the Common Era. It seems after Hillel passed away, this is in the year 10 of the Common Era, it seems it happened after the death of Hillel. But we're not sure the exact date. Of those that were the legislation, one of them was regarding the prohibition of mixed marriages. And the prohibition, where it says, of mixed marriages was a means of a fence of protecting the Jews from becoming idolaters, from losing their connection to the Torah. The Gemara asked the question, why did the rabbis come together to issue new legislation? It has already been covered by the Torah itself. There's a prohibition in the Torah of a non-Jew, which is marrying a Jew, whether male or female. The Gemara answers, that prohibition only applies to the seven nations and not to all nations. The Gemara then point, but Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's opinion is that it applies to all nations. I'm just summarizing. According to that, already the marriage has already been prohibited. How is Rabbi Shimon to understand what the workings of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel? Just as an aside, there's really a question who we rule according to the Rambam maintains we rule like Rabbi Shimon, the prohibition applies to all nations. The Tur, Yaakov ben Asher, says that the Torah prohibition only applies to the seven nations. As we'll see, there's a rabbinic prohibition against all nations. But according to Rabbi Shimon, it has already been covered already. So the Gemara goes and says, well, even the Torah prohibited marriage, their suggestion is, though, that the assembly of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel prohibited relations outside of a marriage. To that, the Gemara says, outside of a marriage, even beyond the seven nations, one cannot publicly have relations one cannot have public relations. A public is not defined in the Gemara public, but we're going to see from the Maritzchias. It seems that something which is well known is considered public. Just as an aside, the Gemara in Sanhedrin 9 Dalet Amud Beis in 74b asked the question, not regarding this, but there's a question that a person publicly desecrates, violates a prohibition of the Torah, one is required to give up their life. And he asked Esther, how could she have relations with Ahasuerus? Since it was known, even though it wasn't done in front of people, it was known, it's public, she should have given up her life. The Gemara has two answers. Rava's answer is that prohibition, I mean that requirement to give up one's life, when it's done in public, is only when the intention of the non-Jew forces a Jew to violate this. One of the laws of the Torah was meant to assimilate the Jew, you know, to show that he can't keep the Torah. But if it was done for his own pleasure, nothing to do with religion, then even if it's done in public, if it's a question of life or death, one is not required to give up one's life. And that's why Esther was allowed to continue her relations, even though it was public, meaning the public knew about this. So in a sense, if a people are living together, even in a public manner, says that it is prohibited. In fact, Kanoim Poigimbo, that like Pinchas, if somebody would be impassioned and seeing this, would be allowed to kill the couple in the act of the of relations. So the basis of the Gemara's question is, why is there an assembly, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, if it already has been prohibited? So it says, the Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, perhaps they prohibited that which was an intimate, non-marital relationship, which was not public. And on that, the Gemara says, that has already been forbidden by a Beis Din, by a rabbinic assembly in the time of the Maccabees. That has already been prohibited. If the Maccabees prohibited a tryst, relations outside of marriage for a Jew and a non-Jew, then there was no what was the purpose? What did Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel do? And the Gemara answers, what they prohibited was not the relations themselves, that has already been prohibited. What they prohibited was seclusion, yichud, with a non-Jew, and that became usur. Just as one by Torah law is not allowed to seclude themselves with someone a man is not allowed to seclude himself with a married woman, not his wife. Because the situation could lead to a compromise, a moral compromise. So too, what they did was they prohibited the yichud of an intimate thing, which is only rabbinically prohibited, and they forbade they went one step further, can't even seclude themselves. They created this barrier ultimately to prevent the relations which would lead to compromising their commitment to Judaism. That is the Gemara. We quote here on page 5, but ultimately it seems that it came as a barrier for idolatry. What happens though if the person you're dealing with is not an idol worshiper? And that we'll see about the question about Christianity. But the person is just not an idol worshiper. Again, if we'll be dealing with a Hindu, You know, so somebody in China, who Taoism, multiple gods. Okay, we understand that's an idolater. It's not so a thing by a Christian, or certainly by a Muslim, which certainly there's no room to think he's an idolater. How does that apply? The Rambam maintains, and we're going to see later on the response of the Maariv Tzfias, Tzfias Chayas, regarding this. But the Rambam writes, he says, he who has, this is on page 5, he has a relation with a female ger tosha, is one who has accepted upon him or herself the presence of Bez and fill all the Noahide laws, is not subject to the law of Kanoyim Pogimbo. No, zealots may attack him. It is not forbidden by Torah law. The Torah law is really only referring to someone who is not a ger tosha. He is flogged, however, makas mardis, the flogging of rebellion, because this applies to all it would seem to be all relations that are not sanctioned by a marriage. Similarly, if a Jewish man and woman have relations without having a chuppah, without having a formal ceremony, it's also in violation of rabbinic law. So this is part of the rabbinic, that one cannot have relations without having a formal, without having a sanctification. Now the question is, how do we view, it's universally maintained that Muslims, and we'll say they may not, there's a question of being a ger tosha. Because a ger tosha, at least how the Rambam learns, has to undergo a formal ceremony just as a ger has to. A ger, what does a ger do? He merely makes in front of a bezna a declaration he's committed to upholding the Torah. There's a ceremony, he has to go to the mikveh, there's a bris milah, or if he already is circumcised, just a symbolic, you know, hatapas dam bris, there's the blood of the covenant. But basically, it's a commitment in front of a Beis Din. A ger toshev, and this is a Gemara in Bechoris, Aflamanon Beis, a ger toshev similarly has to make a commitment in front of a Beis Din. He is committed to uphold the laws of a Ben Noach. What God commands for any human being. There's a minimum standard of every human being. He makes that commitment. He is a ger toshev. That's called a ger toshev. So we'll discuss this, but according to the Rambam, if a person is of the mind of being a ger tosha, but has not yet made the declaration from the Beis Din, he is not yet a ger. It's a gerus. It's a ger tosha. You haven't become a person. Could be in the Hasidim Masoilim, perhaps, you know, considered to be a tzaddik, but he's not a ger tosha. He's not out of the category of humanity in general. Now there's a question about, but a Christian, are they idolaters? As we see, Muslims definitely are not. What about Christians? After all, even though they don't believe in idols, but they believe in the Trinity. They believe in a Godhead instead of a single God. There's a Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit. There's a Trinity, three parts. So how do we view that? You ask a committed Christian, he says it's really one. But then it's not so simple. It's a three or is it one? Also, the fact is that they worship with us as a human being. You know, that he is a God incarnate. That's also very close to traditional idolatry. So that you can understand that it's really not a simple matter how they view Yeshu in Christianity. And we're speaking about Christianity as it was. I mean, the original product of the Catholics and the Orthodox, of course, are Trinitarians. The original Protestants, as a rule, believed in the Trinity. The Unitarians, even as they are only really, compared to the, you know, really an insignificant minority within the Christians. So the Rambam maintains, just on page 5, Christians, because the census changed the text, the original text reads Notzrim, are considered by idolaters, and Sunday, it's the Lord's Day, this is every Sunday, is their official holiday. Therefore, in the land of Israel, it's forbidden to do business with them. It's considered in the land of Israel they're more religious. Somehow, the spirit of Israel. To do business with them on Thursday or Friday of any week, like 3 days before. And it goes without saying it's forbidden on Sunday itself, which is universally forbidden, even outside of Israel. So this law applies to any of their holidays. Thus, he views them as idolaters. This is the Rambam's opinion. It seems that Tosfos, and I quote here, is of the same opinion. Here's number two, I didn't translate it. That it is forbidden to sell them, and basically we're dealing with people in France at the time, we're dealing with Christians, they call them idolaters, anything that could be used for their ceremonies, incense, a prayer book, a chalice to be used for their ceremonies, for the mass. It's forbidden to sell them anything that could be used. However, and this, we begin the quote here on the bottom page 5 and then page 6, there is an opinion which is based on a certain reading of a Tosfos, that the kind of idolatry which is the form that Christianity takes is not forbidden for non-Jews, for B'nai Noach, only forbidden for Jews. There's a Tosfos, a question of interpreting that Tosfos. According to that interpretation, for a Jew would be considered idolatry, for a Ben Noach not. And therefore, according to that, you would be allowed to sell them religious items. This is how the Rama understands this. Time doesn't, to allow us to go further into the argument about whether they are or not. But as it stands, the Rambam and Tosfos maintains they are idolaters. It would seem the Ramah, based on his reading, and it's not a certain reading, it's a reading of the Tosfos, that they only are idolaters in our eyes. In other words, for a Jew would not be allowed to believe in the Trinity or the Incarnation. However, a Christian is not in violation of the laws of Noah. But the assembly in Brunswick seemed to assume that Christianity is a valid form of monotheism. And they're not idolaters. And the prohibition of marrying an idolatress would not apply to marrying a Christian woman. That's their assumption. And with that, I would like to quote from their from the minutes of the meeting to give you a sense of their mindset, to give you a sense of their scholarship, so to speak, and understand the chasm that divided the Reform rabbinate with the mainstream rabbinate. Here, on page 6. The debate was on the third question asked of the French Sanhedrin: may a Jewish woman marry a Christian woman a Jew? Or is it the intent of Jewish law that Jews should marry only each other? Answer of this Sanhedrin, this was the marriage with Christians is not forbidden. This is how they understood what the French Sanhedrin came. Motion of the commission. Now, these are the rabbis of Brunswick, and there was a motion given to the assembly. Marriage between Jews and Christians, in fact, marriage between monotheists in general, are not forbidden. That would be the resolution that they would vote on. Dr. Mendel Hess, this is the chief rabbi of the Duchy of Weimar, says, I agree. This is all the debate. But with the following addition, such marriages are not forbidden and the rabbi is permitted to officiate. Mendel Hess was one of the most radical of the Reform, and was one of the first to institute reforms, really, in his rabbinate. And he was so ahead of his time that it took the Reform movement over 2 centuries to take his position. Baruch Schott was the director of the Jacobson School in Sisson. We discussed Jacobson, who was the founder of Reform, and Sisson was a school, which was a school, a Jewish school of general studies, and even had non-Jews in it. The integrity of the Sanhedrin is proven the way that it formulated its answer. It said marriage between Jews and Christians is not forbidden. It did not say it is permitted. There's a difference. Such a marriage may be permitted, yet there would be practical difficulties, as for instance in the marriage service or the ritual of engagement or divorce proceedings. Since these questions touch so widely on practical issues, I am for postponing this whole matter for the time being. Dr. Joseph Mayer, again, we had quoted him before, and he's the president of the Rabbinic Assembly in Brunswick. The Sanhedrin was cautious, but it remained entirely in accord with the Talmud. Where there is a civil marriage, there is no objection to it from a rabbinic point of view. And he's quoting here between two non-Jews, not a Jew and a non-Jew. Bulas bal yesh lahen, i.e. the legality of Gentile marriage is based upon conjugal relations, but there's no binding religious marriage ceremony. Nichlas alachupa v'lenivala ein lahem. Because they don't have chupa and kedusha. Entering to the canopy alone does not create a legally binding marriage for Gentiles. The president objects to making a difference between forbidden and permitted. In other words, he really quoted this as really not germane to this discussion. But basically, he wants it to be, he wants them to vote that it is permitted. Dr. Samuel Holdheim, again, one of the most radical of the Reform rabbis, agrees with the church counselor Mayer. However, according to present Jewish religious marriage law, religious or synagogal forms are not necessary for the marriage ceremony. These have been introduced because of a well-recognized need to give marriage a church sanction also. All of us feel urged to consider as legally necessary that which has manifested itself as a need, like the religious form at the time of the marriage ceremony. However, this is not yet law. First, we must satisfy our conscience in the laws of the Sanhedrin. The marriage of a Jew with a monotheist is not forbidden. In the practical sense, however, we could do no other than to advise against mixed marriages if they are to be concluded without assuring the freedom of religious education. The issue that they were touching upon, on one hand, they wanted to make a formal declaration to allow mixed marriage because that would gain favor in the eyes of the government and they would most readily grant them full, you know, emancipation, full rights. On the other hand, they realized that if they opened the floodgates, they would lose the children. Dr. Ludwig Philipson, Rabbi Magdeburg, agrees with Holdheim, but refers to the formulation of his own proposal, as he had, namely that in mixed marriages, the possibility should not be precluded that children might be brought up in the Jewish religion. In other words, it is important to note that according to the laws of the state, in Germany, a child of a mixed marriage had to be brought up as a Christian. Dr. Nafoli Frankfurter, he was the preacher at the Hamburg Temple. Hamburg did not have a rabbi, they had a preacher. We would not have raised the question, for we understand its difficulty. We know too well that mixed marriages are neither desirable from a practical nor a theoretical religious point of view, even when it accords with the sense and the words of the Sanhedrin, which close the matter as far as the laws of the state is concerned. But since the question has come up before us, we must answer it forthrightly. A reservation of the answer is not permissible. I am also of the opinion that mixed marriages should be admissible only if there is freedom of religious education for children born in such wedlock. In order to achieve this, an addition should be made which should be separate from the answer itself. Mayer, this question is simple. Are such mixed marriages permitted? There could be no reservation in this regard. He wanted it just that they should be on record to permit it. Dr. Levi Hertzfeld was the chief rabbi of Brunswick. In principle, I'm satisfied with the answer of the Sanhedrin. We're thinking of practical matters. I would very much like to pass this paragraph by. Again, he wanted it shelved. For we are desirous that our resolution should be accepted by the people. And by, in other words, he says, if we make such a public pronouncement, the people at large will be up in arms. And he continues, and by dealing with this question at all, we would act in contrast to this very wish. Furthermore, as one may judge from the teaching which goes on in Christian schools, Christians' love towards Jews has not progressed far enough to make a marriage between Jews and Christians desirable. And then it says, there were many objections in the assembly against this last expression. You can imagine what broke out there. Then Hess, again, what is our objective in this discussion? And what are our resolutions on this point? Everything is in vain if we do not add, as I've already proposed, the religious marriage of such a union may be performed by Jewish clergymen. And Dr. Samuel Adler, the rabbi of Alze, is against the acceptance of the whole matter because he does not believe that it belongs to the task of the rabbinic assembly. For what does the permission of mixed marriages do to the revitalization of the religious spirit? If one has to say something about it, then for the time being, contrary to Holtheim's remarks, must be considered as undecided whether the education of the children of Jewish religion may indeed be a condition for such a marriage. He proceeds to explain his point of view. Shot against all Holtheim, even though the ceremonies could be omitted at a Jewish marriage, the Hariat Mekudeshesli says your sanctum must not be missing, for the sacredness of marriage is already expressed. Again, the president already says, okay, enough discussion. The president asks, shall the proposal commission be accepted in the following formulation? Marriages between Jews and Christians, in fact, marriages with monotheists in general are not forbidden. The vote is taken, the majority votes no. Does not want this passed. Phillipson rephrases the motion the following manner. Members of monotheistic religions in general are not forbidden to marry if the parents are permitted by the laws of the state to bring up children from such wedlock in the Jewish religion. The majority agrees to the motion. And then there's a list of those who voted against it and those who abstained. But as I said before, this actually was the permission of mixed marriages based on the proviso that the child be raised in the Jewish religion made this whole vote really a moot point, as there were no Jew or German states at the time would have allowed a child of a Christian to be raised as a Jew. Now, the Orthodox opposition to the Brunswick Assembly in general, and the above resolution in particular, was immediate and fierce. I would first like to quote an excerpt from a tshuva response from Rav Tzvi Chayes, the Rav of Zalkova, one of the great Talmudic scholars of his time, whose commentary to the Talmud is printed as an addendum to the standard Talmudic text. Rav Chayes was also a person who was uniquely familiar with the scholarly works of the Maskilim. The entire tshuva is printed in your notes. I'm not going to read the entire tshuva, but I'd just like to touch upon that which I underlined. And he begins with Basifas Braunschweig, Hetiru Rabbonim, in the assembly of Brunswick, the rabbis allowed marriage between a Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman. I don't know what they're going to do with the express prohibition of the Torah that one is not allowed on both ends, that a Jewish man can't marry a non-Jewish woman, and a Jewish woman can't marry a non-Jewish man. The Rambam maintains that it is forbidden from the Torah. And we have in the book of Ezra that there were mixed marriages, and he forced them to separate. He goes on just to explain the position of the Tur, who maintains that marriages between non-Jews other than the seven nations are not prohibited by the Torah law, but he goes on to show that they are prohibited. They are prohibited if A, in general rabbinic law, and B, says if it was done publicly. As if it's known, it isn't. Then he goes on to explain that he had published something on the subject, and he received a letter from Avrom Yener, who was the Rosh Eisav Bezdin in Krakow at the time. And he goes and brings up certain points, but he goes and says, he reiterates his position, this is on page 9 of the underline, says, you should know, says Rabbi Yenner writes to Rav Chayes, we've heard that you've raised a strong voice in opposition against Reform Rabbinic Assembly in Brunswick. But he says there should be a difference between monotheists and non-monotheists. And Christians are monotheists. And they should, be at least like the Ger Toshev. So again, the right, he pointed in reply, he says, first of all, the Rambam says even the Ger Toshev is prohibited, at least rabbinically, when it's flogged. And also he says that a monotheist by itself, even if we would assume Christians to be monotheists, which is not simple, but then to be a Ger Toshev and to have a different status, one would have to go in front of a Beis Din. Well, none of them are gone from a Beis Din. The Rambam's opinion is, Bizman Hazeh, we don't have a land, we don't have Beis HaMikdash, we don't even convene such a Beis Din. So he says it's a moot point. But there's a summary of this. In conclusion, I would like to quote a sampling of the reaction to the Brunswick Assembly from the Orthodox rabbinate in general. The first is from the introduction to the Malbim's landmark commentary to Torah's Kohanim, the Halachic Medrash to Sefer Vayikra, the Book of Leviticus. Malbim, which is short for Meir Lipa ben Yechiel Mechel, was one of the most brilliant Talmudic and biblical scholars of his day. He wrote his commentary as a response to the reform-minded rabbi's derisive view of the drushas, the rabbinic interpretations of Chazal, our sages of blessed memory, to show every drusha is clearly inherent in the text and is based upon self-evident principles in Hebrew grammar and style. The impetus for him to write his commentary was, in fact, the Brunswick Assembly. The following is an excerpt from the beginning of the Malbim's commentary. This is on our notes on page 10. The next quote is an excerpt, is from a letter of protest which was signed initially by 77 Orthodox Rabbonim, the majority of who came from Germany or Hungary, later an additional 39 Rabbonim has assigned their signatures to this document. And here on page 10, in the year 1844, I heard, this is how the Malbim says very poetically, I heard a voice as of a woman in labor and the cries of anguish, as of her who brings forth her first child, the voice of God's Torah sobbing and spreading out her hands with her tears on her cheeks, for her friends have dealt treacherously with her. For some of the shepherds of the flock of the Jews of Germany have lost their mind and have provoked God. They assembled to destroy the religion of Israel and its laws, conspired against its treasures. Many shepherds assembled together to consume their flocks. They call themselves rabbis, preachers, and cantors, but in fact, they're slaughterers of their congregations. They gather together in the city of Brunswick in the valley of Sidim, like Sodom. It says, shattered the empty jars and the torches appeared. This is a reference to the story of Gideon. Gideon. Then they gathered together little foxes and placed brands on their tails. This is a story like Samson of Shimshon. And the fire ignited, says, briars and thorns and consumed everything in its path from stacks of grain to the standing grain, even the olive orchards. It continued on to consume the sanctuary of God, the area between the staves and the Ark of the Covenant. It had in mind to destroy the tablets of stone and all that is holy in the land. That's how we... And here it says on page 11, this is taken again from the letter. It was really authored originally by Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, one of the great Rabbonim of the time, who was the chief rabbi, it says, at Altona. We were dedicating one of the lectures to him. It was composed by him, but it was signed by all of these rabbis. And he begins to, from a quote from Ezekiel Yecheskel, if the watchmen see the sword coming, does not blow the shofar and the people are not warned, if the sword comes and takes any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity. But his blood will require of the watchman's hand. That's basically saying, we the Rabbonim have to make a protest. And you, O son of man, I have set you as a watchman to the house of Israel, therefore you shall hear the word from my mouth and warn them from me. This was the charge that Ezekiel had to warn the people of the coming doom. And it continues on, this past June, more than 20 men arose and assembled in the city of Brunswick and referred to this as a quote-unquote rabbinical assembly, even though many of those in attendance were not rabbis at all, nor bore that official title. Even those of them who bore that official title were openly associated with the Jewish Reform Movement. They made certain decisions in regards to some religious practice and ceremonies, prepared themselves to make further decisions in that regard in upcoming assemblies. Any serious observer stands dumbfounded seeing that such a small group of people have the audacity to call themselves the German Rabbinical Assembly, as a majority of them are not at all involved in the study of rabbinic writings and openly and publicly demean the teachings of the Talmud. And yet they make the claim they are most qualified to lead Jewry and guide its rabbinate. Based upon the spiritual direction of the leadership of the assembly, there's no hope of any positive outcome. Despite the fact that for some time now they have continued to publicize their heretical opinions, which has had a negative influence upon the Jewish community, had the members of this assembly humbly admitted their knowledge of Jewish religion was very limited. We, the undersigned, would have remained silent, all the while feeling pain in our hearts with prayers for the return of our wayward brethren. Unfortunately, they took another approach and publicized their decisions, indicating their desire to uproot the laws of Shabbos, which was given over to us through the Holy One, blessed be He, through black fire, written upon white fire, inscribed upon the holy tablets of the covenant. And it continues on, anyone who has not desired to deny truth and faith and his mission to fulfill and spread Torah needs to know this insipid belief system has no room within Judaism. And it continues on, therefore, those that are completely committed to the faith of Israel shouldn't allow themselves to accept the reforms and innovations because of their dire predictions. Their sole purpose is to increase superficiality and to hasten assimilation. Continue to maintain your faith in the Holy One, blessed be He, desires the welfare of all of His children, His creations on earth. Cling unto Him so that He will soon heal the sickness of the craving for materialism. So too pray that He may effect repentance amongst those in error to return to the true faith of the Torah. In the meantime, besides for our scrupulous observance of our obligations to the government and our homeland, it is incumbent upon us to protect the fortress of our ancient faith. This is particularly true in regard to those people who pretend to be our friends in order that we not disturb them in their efforts to undermine the foundations of our Torah. We should, however, open up our ranks to include the penitents, the Balei Tshuva amongst us, and to stretch out our hands in brotherly love. It's 5,605 years from creation. Protests came from other circles as well. The chief rabbi of Prague, Shlomo Yehuda Leib Rappaport, a person who was involved in Wissenschaft, the critical analysis of Jewish texts and history, maintained personal friendships with many of those associated with Reform. Addressing himself directly to the Reform Assembly, which convened in Frankfurt the next year, in 1845, he quoted from the Mishnah in Edios, this is in chapter 1, Mishnah 5. No court may set aside the decrees of another court unless it is greater than it in wisdom and in number. Since the Reform Rabbinic Assembly could not make such a claim, it was wrong and sinful to attempt to make any such changes. He also told them that although they were under pressure to make changes by their constituents, they should merely respond to them that the sole task of the rabbin is to teach people all that has been transmitted from former generations. Any permissible change would naturally occur without their premeditated intervention. In Rappaport's words, Should there be among our customs and laws some matter which requires reform or renewal, is the passage of time which will bring about the reform or renewal. Now, there's a certain changes that occur naturally. Generally, we don't say piyutim anymore. Now, there's certain changes that occur. But it isn't something that are legislated. Another outspoken critic was Rabbi Zacharia Frankel, the chief rabbi of Saxony. His opinions and approach will be covered in the next lecture. All of these criticisms did not faze those who were bent upon reforming Judaism. And they met the following year in Frankfurt to continue their program. That and the other subsequent assemblies will be the subject of coming lectures. Now, are there any questions? Yeah. No, the question was, how did the rabbinical assembly take it upon themselves to cancel the oath that was a government opposed by the government? They made no such claim. They basically said, it is our resolution that this should be abandoned, and this we are want to convey our sentiments to the government. No, they couldn't. It was not in their power. It was just that we've come together and tell that we have to work on it to somehow convince the government. And we can't tolerate this. And this, amongst all of the resolutions, was really something that was accepted by all of Jewry, not just the Reform. You're asking, if they really did not hold of this, you know, why did... I don't believe those who really, like Geiger and Holdheim, really did not have to find any justification. But they had to go back to their congregants and have to justify themselves. I mean, very often we find amongst the conservative movement that which they made alterations, they had to find some basis, according to their understanding, that is not... We haven't totally abandoned the halacha, because the fear that if you're going to say that, then why should we be Jewish at all? But the truth is, people like Mendel Tess, Avraham Geiger, Samuel Holdheim, really did not need any of this. They really didn't believe in this. They believed in a sense, and this is with Geiveld, that Judaism was superior to Christianity. It was much more of a monotheistic religion. They also viewed, and this is something in Mirz Hashem we will get to the lecture of Sham Shmuel Hirsch, but they believed in the mission of Israel, and this was slide here, that Jews have a special mission in God's eyes to somehow make a positive spiritual imprint on humanity as a whole. So they did not want to abandon their Jewishness. But they wanted their expression to be really in line with the educated Lutheran of the day, which really abandoned most of the ritual.
But if a male Jew was going to marry a female Christian, they hadn't gone to patrilineal descent or anything, there was no conversion. Did they have an issue about whether the children were Jewish?
They did not deal with this at all.
Okay.
They did not in this assembly. Afterwards, things did come up, but it did not. But again, they had this. On one hand, they really did not want to do anything. They wanted to live an assimilated life, and it made it a lot easier. In that way, they could be accepted by society. On the other hand, they realized that in doing so completely, they would no longer exist. So they had to have certain boundaries. And that the issue of the boundaries for Reformed Jews is still an issue to this day. Yeah, so you're asking that today there are no boundaries. Well, you see how successful they were. They were very successful. They're so successful that that we're witnessing now that really the dissolution of anything outside of Orthodoxy. They're just very successful. Well, the question is what they want to accomplish.
You said that in the 1844 conference, that they laid out broad general outlines, but they said two specific ones. Yeah. One was Talitza.
They made two resolutions, which is to abolish Kol Nidre, which is interesting that even though they made this resolution, but the people as a whole did not want to abandon it. It's so beautiful. And there was all kinds of what to do with it, to keep just the melody without the words. They have all kinds of, you think you have problems. They have, you know, if you were going to go through the different assemblies, they really had problems dealing with this. But that was one resolution. And the other resolution was to make the effort to do away with the oath. In terms of marriage, they set up commissions, which did not make, and they didn't make any resolutions at this point about how to modify the marriage. You know, later on they did away, you know, on the basis they, at future assemblies or the synods, they did away, they resolved to make these changes.
With the levirate marriage?
With the levirate marriage.
That was later.
Later. And this is all they now, at this point, you know, they made commissions.
They made what?
Committees. Uh-huh. They made committees, and they would, at a later point, they would give their recommendations to the assembly as a whole, and they would vote on their recommendations.
So they started with acts of commission, and they ended up with acts of omission.
But that's this point.
I thought Chalitza, even by the Orthodox, there is no more Chalitza.
No, you're asking, Chalitza still, there's no Yibum. In other words, they don't generally, if a person dies without children and leaves a wife, and based on the Talmud, the other one does not make Yibum, he does not marry, but the dissolution ceremony, the Chalitza ceremony is made. Yeah. Gute Woche.